From the racetracks around Australia, here's Inside Motorsports.
Hello, I'm Craig Revell.
I'm Colin Ford.
And I'm Peter Norton. Welcome to this week's episode of Inside Motorsport.
Yes, we've got a bumper show coming up. We've got qualifying news and other bits from NASCAR, qualifying from Toronto for the Kart FedEx Championship. We have a look at last weekend's Indy Racing League race. We also will have a look at the V8 racing from Calder Park this weekend. But first, let's go across to the BBC and get their qualifying report from Formula One and Great Britain.
Ferrari said they didn't get the best out of Michael Schumacher's car, but try telling that to McLaren. The world champion had an answer each time Mika Hakkinen looked like grabbing his first pole of the year. Little sign of him winding down and out of the sport. David Coulthard chased his first Silverstone pole as hard as Schumacher, but that half-a-second gap to the title leader told its own story. The hat-trick of British victories that Coulthard is chasing will take some going from row two if Schumacher's in the groove, but McLaren team orders could yet play a part. They'll also be helped by Rubens Barrichello, who could only manage sixth. Williams' recent run of success came to an end. Ralph Schumacher was only 10th. Juan Pablo Montoya was two places better. Both, though, failed to complete their allocation of laps. So it was that the Jordans of Jarno Trulli and Heinz Alfredson were best of the rest, fourth and fifth respectively. Their Honda rivals at British American Racing were well beaten out of the top 10. Eddie Irvine's hopes of impressing in his home crowd won't be too good. He was down in 15th, and Jenson Button had to make do with 18th, but at least he had the satisfaction of pipping his teammate Giancarlo Fisichella.
That was Jonathan Ledgett of the BBC with the Formula One qualifying report for the British Grand Prix. Of course, we're looking at that grid there. Michael Schumacher on pole with Mika Hakkinen in the McLaren alongside him. Then David Coulthard in McLaren, Jarno Trulli in the first of the Jordans, Heinz-Harald Frentzen, second of the Jordans, Rubens Barrichello, second of the Ferraris, is rounds out the top six. Then in seventh place, Kimi Räikkönen in the Sauber, eighth, Juan Pablo Montoya in the Williams, ninth, Nick Heidfeld in the Sauber, tenth, Ralf Schumacher in the second of the Williams, then Olivier Panis in the BAR, Jacques Villeneuve in the BAR, Pedro de la Rosa in the Jaguar, Jean Alesi in the Prost, Eddie Irvine in the Jaguar is at 15, Luciano Berti in the Prost, Jos Verstappen Arrows, Jenson Button in the Benetton is at 18th, Giancarlo Fisichella in second of the Benetton is 19th, Enrique Bernoldi in the second of the Arrows 20, and 21 and 22 is Fernando Alonso and Tato Marquez in the two Minardis. We now cross to the post-qualifying press conference at the British Grand Prix.
Listen, Mika Hakkinen second and David Coulthard third. Michael, we normally have an hour for qualifying, but today we ran just basically half an hour with all of you going out for four runs. So talk me through your practice, your qualifying session.
Well, basically everybody was waiting for everybody to get out and do the first experience, see whether the circuit is somewhere still damp, where we don't see it, and clean it up maybe even. But everybody thought the same, so nobody was going out really, so it was a bit of a rush last half an hour. And I mean, all day was a bit exciting, honestly, with the heavy rain we had this morning. And then in qualifying, we lost the computers. I mean, we didn't have lap times anymore. So it was very difficult to know where we lost out for time. And at one stage, I was obviously second. So it was a bit of a rush through doing four runs in half an hour. But nothing to complain, to be honest, because we did the best job with it. So that's good.
But as we just said, four runs in half an hour. Can you do anything to change the car in that time, or is it just a case of four straight runs?
No, it's fine-tuning of the car, yes. You definitely change the car, because we haven't had any running in the dry today at all. So naturally, you do some changes.
Michael, thank you very much. Mika, you're the only one of the three sitting at the table here who improved on their fourth and final run. Could you have improved by even more?
Yes, no, but there's a reasons off the way you could say you could have done better, and obviously it was, you know, we went out something like 2 minutes before the end, and obviously there was like 6-7 cars front of me before the second last corner, so obviously you have to slow down a lot and to try to find the right gap, and it's very difficult indeed. And obviously, because David was behind me, I couldn't leave it for absolutely for last second for me. That's why I'm thinking about. Otherwise, he cannot get a time lap, and it's no reason to start racing teammates which one is to, goes first to the time lap. So it's very, you have to be a bit compromised. So when I picked my time lap, probably I was behind the Benetton last two corners, so the possibility there is lost maybe tenth or two. But then again, I have to look at the times and study if there was any loss in the last sector. So, but very, very, very happy about generally the performance of the car and the team today.
Certainly, looking at that performance, particularly on that final lap, it didn't look like a lap of someone who's contemplating retirement, as the stories have been flying around this weekend.
Yeah. I heard the same stories, yes.
Okay, thank you very much, Mika. David, third place on the grid, that would be maybe slight disappointment for you, but you only squeaked in by 0.03 of a second ahead of Jarno Trulli.
Yeah, but I'm in front, so that's the important thing. And, you know, too disappointed with qualifying. I don't feel that I've got the balance I'm looking for in the car so far this weekend in the wet or dry. So to be, you know, where I could be quite close considering the balance I have out in the track, then I'm reasonably optimistic for the performance in the race.
Looking ahead to the race, you've won here in 1999 and 2000. Is the weather going to really play a big role tomorrow?
Well, if weather plays up, then yes, it will play a big role, but I don't know, sitting here, what's going to happen. And, you know, we have to race whatever the conditions, so I'm not unduly concerned if it's wet or dry. So I think that our relative race performance is a bit better than we are qualifying. And in the wet, you can see it's all pretty much close, depending on when you're on the track.
Thank you, David. Back to you, Michael. Looking ahead to tomorrow, you won here in 98. It was also wet then. Tomorrow, whether it's wet or dry, you've got two McLaren drivers close to you and your teammate Rubens Barrichello somewhat further down. Is that going to be a problem for you?
I'm used to fight against two silver cars or two blue cars, whatever, so it doesn't really matter very much who is next to you. You have to fight them down, whoever it is, and we will try our best to achieve this tomorrow. It's obviously important for us to get another victory in, because although people may think championship looks easy, but still there's 70 points to give, and we wanna be on the safe side. So we will try to make a good race, make it a bit entertaining, hopefully to the spectators, and have the good end for us in the end.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Well, they're the people who brought us conspiracy theories, grassy knolls, and, of course, World Federation Wrestling. And, of course, we're talking about the Americans, and in particular, the people way down south. And the good old boys are heading to a brand new track in Chicago this weekend for the Winston Cup Championship. However, most of the talk going into this race is more about the previous race at Daytona and whether there has been a bit of a setup for Dale Earnhardt Jr. to avenge his father's death back in February by winning the Pepsi 400 last weekend. All sorts of suggestions about whether he had a bit of a hand from the NASCAR officials in terms of a larger hole in the restrictor plate or something to give him a bit more power. And the rumours have been flying in some of the press, particularly some of the newspapers in Florida, and some of the other drivers like Johnny Benson and Jimmy Spencer are sort of suggesting that something looked a bit amiss, particularly how Earnhardt seemed to have the power outside of the draft. He could still drive away from the pack, something that's absolutely unheard of within NASCAR restrictor plate racing. Mind you, the little E is fighting back, and thanks to ESPN, we've got this snippet from an interview with little E where he explains that everything is above board and it was one of his greatest victories ever, one he's proud of, and he's very disappointed that any cloud is being placed over it.
It really bothers me that Jimmy would say something. Any driver, I mean, this is a guy that is, I mean, you come into this sport as a driver and the great race car drivers are the guys that love the sport. They love the race. They love the competition. We're racing on NASCAR stage. This is their ballpark, and they have made this what it is for us to come in here and race. And he's just taking a shot at their credibility. Everything that they stand for. I mean, that's just really foolish in my eyes that he would he would make that comment. I don't think anybody would ever question the fact whether the race was fixed or not until one of the drivers spoke up. And when you got somebody that's actually driving in the race that says that, it's got some substance to it. So it's just a shame that they didn't think first before they spoke, because it's really snowballed into a lot of heartache for me, and it's took a lot away from the win. I mean, it was one of the proudest moments of my career, and one that I'll always remember, but it'll always be tainted with this this conspiracy. It's pretty difficult to have to, you know, have to defend yourself for no reason, period. I mean, just because somebody mouthed off a driver after the race, made some comments, and a couple guys in some papers down in Florida that we're not real fond of made some comments. So, you know, it's just a shame, because it snowballs from there. That's all you need, just a spark to ignite the fire, and it's definitely flaming up. So we're just having to defend ourselves right and left over this controversy that the race was fixed. And it's a shame, because it was one of the biggest moments of my career, and one that I'll always cherish, but it'll kind of be tainted because of the questions and the things that have arose from this. And hopefully one day, you know, it'll kind of go away, or people will understand and realize that it was won outright and fair and square. A lot of people question the fact whether we were legal or not, and whether NASCAR may have slipped us a little extra horsepower or something. So it really, when I first heard about it, really upset me pretty bad. You know, but I know in my heart that we won the race fair and square, and the next ass whooping will be just as real as the last.
But getting back to the racetrack, where these things should really be sorted out, it's some brand new names at the front of the field for racing at this brand new track. And it's Ford's up the front from the Haas Carter Motorsport teammates. Todd Bodine and Jimmy Spencer have swept the top positions for Sunday's race at the new Chicagoland Speedway. Todd Bodine explained that it didn't take long to sort out the new track.
No, for whatever reason, the new racetracks I've adapted to really quickly. And fortunately, this style of racetrack seems to be one of my best. And, you know, we unloaded quick. We were decent yesterday, but this morning when we changed the motor, changed the setup a little bit, got some good Yates horsepower on the hood, the car really came alive. We were fast right off the bat this morning, and we just had to fine-tune the car, and every little adjustment we made just made it a little bit better here, a little bit better there, and it all added up to being a real good lap.
Pole sitter Bodine also went on to describe what the new track's like.
It's fast. It's a neat racetrack. It's very different than anything we've run on. You know, it's got a little bit of a lot of different racetracks in it, a little bit of California, a little bit of Texas, a lot of Las Vegas. I mean, it's different. The round back straightaway really... it's hard to imagine, but it really makes the racetrack forgiving and really fast, a momentum racetrack. And there's only two bumps in the whole racetrack, and I don't think this race is going to have so much a second groove, but in a couple of years, you're going to see an awful lot of good racing on this track.
Looking at some of the other qualifying efforts, it was Ricky Rudd, who drives for Robert Yates Racing, who made it three Robert Yates engines in a row to take out the third position. He was followed by the Dodge of Billy Elliott and the Chevrolets of Joe Nemechek and Kevin Harvick, followed by Mike Skinner and Jerry Nadeau. Rounding out the top 10 were the Dodge of Sterling Marlin and the Ford of Brett Bodine. So some of the more notable names that you would expect at the front of NASCAR really weren't there. They were struggling to get their setup right for this brand new track. A disappointing effort was turned in by the points leader, Jeff Gordon, who qualified 28th. Dale Jarrett, who's only 48 points behind Gordon in the championship, qualified 11th. Dale Earnhardt Jr., who won so convincingly last weekend, he qualified 36th. Michael Waltrip, Earnhardt's teammate, was the second place finisher last weekend, but he was one of the seven drivers who were added to the rear of the field as provisional starters. Some of the people who didn't qualify included Kyle Petty, Dave Marcus, and Mike Bliss. We will, of course, bring you up to date with the results and any other developments from the world of NASCAR next week.
Last weekend, the IRL was at Kansas City, and how's this for a finish?
White flag is out. This is the final lap of the Ameristar Casino Indy 200. Cheever leads Hornish by less than a car length there in turn number two.
Cheever sets it down to the white line. Sam Hornish goes right along with him, the left car to deal with. Eddie Cheever right in front. Then Hornish, then Meisler in the turn three. Get him home, Mike King.
Here comes Eddie Cheever. Is he going to be able to make it work? Holds off Sam Hornish Jr. off of turn number four to the tri-oval. Checkered flag is out. Eddie Cheever has won the Ameristar Casino Indy 200.
Mike King, the Kansas City fans were certainly heated up, not only with the temperature, but with the IRL on their brand new Speedway.
They've got the fever, in Kansas and in Missouri. Of course, as we mentioned, the Speedway literally lies right on the line, the state line between Kansas and Missouri, and certainly fans of both states very proud of this facility. Six yellows, 42 laps today of the 200 that were run here. Two incidents that were the most serious of the day, one of them involving Scott Sharp, our pole sitter. He walked away uninjured. The other one involving Jared Schrader, he also walked away uninjured. That's the good news there. The other four caution flags were for either debris or for blown engines here at the Speedway. Eddie Cheever is the winner today.
It was an awesome track. I had an unfair advantage, and that advantage was infinity. My engine was tremendous today. Very hard day on tires. I was very glad to have some really well-engineered tires underneath me because we abused the hell out of them today. And I'm glad for my team. They've done a great job. Now if we can just win a few more, we might get back to top three in the championship. I'm very happy, and I had so much fun racing with Hornish. That guy is a phenomenal racing driver, and he's fair. I wish more people in the IRL would drive like he does.
If we take a look at the full field rundown, this scoring report is brought to you by Pennzoil, the official motor oil of the Indy Racing Northern Lights Series. Eight races down, five remain in this 2001 season, and Eddie Cheever Jr. has given Infiniti, the 35A, its first taste of victory, the second win for the engine manufacturer, but it comes 1 week after Oldsmobile clinches the Manufacturer's Championship. So Eddie Cheever is the winner, turning the fastest lap of the race on the final lap at 216.241 miles an hour. Sam Hornish Jr. winds up second for the third consecutive event.
Eddie had a little bit more at the end of the straightaway than we did. We were handling a little bit better, but we'll take second place. It's our third one in a row. We're just trying to stack up those points as much as we can get, and after that stall I had in the pits, I'm just glad that we finished second. Benzo Panther guys did an awesome job in the pits for me again today, and had a great handling car. Got to thank Andy Brown and all the people at Benzo Panther Racing.
You won't be going directly back to Indianapolis. You're going to be jetting to Nashville to do some testing this week.
Yeah, we're gonna try that track out, see how we like it. We weren't liking this one too much until today, and we got it. I love Kansas now. Only one thing could make it a little bit better, but we keep stacking up those points, so that's the main thing.
Donnie Beekstra was third.
Very happy. We had a race car today, and we had some patience out there. I didn't really have anything for him at the end. I blistered a few tires, but Firestone tires worked wonderful all day, and I can't complain. But, it's a good run for me because I'm not a full-time deal right now with this thing. I'm kind of bucking for position, but hopefully this will help, and we'll get to go to Nashville and give it a try again. But, I mean, my guys... We got a new associate sponsor, Mr. Good Sense, that came on board. Harris, those guys have done a wonderful job for us.
You feel okay?
Yeah, I feel great. I mean, I think this deal right now is, it's not as bad as, I mean, you guys are baking in the sun. At least we have some type of shade out there, and we can kind of break our visor when we're done.
Felipe Giafone was fourth. Buddy Lazier wound up fifth. Ayer Tendari was sixth. Take a look at the unofficial point standing. Sam Hornish Jr. now has a 60-point lead on Buddy Lazier as we get set to head to Nashville in a couple of weeks. Hornish with 309 points. Buddy Lazier with 249 points. Eliseo Salazar is tied with Felipe Giafone, third in points, and he finds himself, both Salazar and Giafone find themselves 92 points off the pace. So if they're going to make a move, they're going to have to do it starting at Nashville. It looks like this is very quickly becoming a two-driver race for the Northern Lights Cup. Scott Sharp is fifth in points with 214, so he finds himself 94 points back, or making 95 points back. Then Alan Sir Jr., Billy Boat, Eddie Cheever, Buzz Calkins, and Greg Ray fill out the top 10.
The Kart FedEx Championship moves to the streets of Toronto this weekend, where they'll catch up with some of my old buddies from that city by the lake. And after qualifying, and it was quite an action-packed qualifying session with many cars coming in with scrapes and bumps, but one guy who stayed away from that to get his first pole position for the year was Jill DeFerrin, who explained how staying clean and out of trouble during qualifying helped him out.
Been a really clean weekend for us, and obviously the whole team is doing very well. I mean, we unloaded with a very good car right from the start, so it's just a matter of getting everything right.
Starting from second position will be the guy who is currently second in the championship, and that is Helio Cashmevers. He's not too fussed about starting from the number two position because he points out that pole position has rarely converted into a win around the streets of Toronto.
So basically, I was great for the team. You know, it's our first row. That was a long time. Quentin Penske didn't do a first front row, so I'm very happy with this result. Well, I understand that the drivers starting the pole position do not win a race. I guess I'm gonna cheer for that.
Starting third for the race in Toronto will be the current series leader, Kenny Brack, who's hoping for a pretty clean run throughout the race to convert into some plenty more points towards his championship aspirations.
We fell, came a little short, but the Shell 4 ran great, and we all did a, Team Rail did a fantastic job, you know, rebounding from the trouble we had yesterday. We didn't run the first session and so forth, so we're okay. We're a little short, but as I said, it's third is a good position.
Running through the top 10 now, we've got Tony Kanaan in fourth, Alex Tagliani, a Canadian who's hoping to do well in a local event, in fifth, Dario Franchitti will be starting sixth, Adrian Fernandez 7th, Toronto boy Paul Tracy will be starting 8th, and he'll be definitely a crowd favourite, and he's sort of been left on the outer in the team strategy. Normally the team Cool Green put their three cars together to assist each other in and out of the pit lane type of strategies, but because he had such a poor run in the previous race, he's sort of been left out in the cold, having a single pit bay and having to contend with other teams in front and directly behind him. He's not particularly happy about that situation at all, and had his manager called into the track to have a chat to the team owners. Starting from ninth position will be Roberto Moreno, and rounding out the top 10 will be Kiwi Scott Dixon, putting in yet another good run. Notable performances just outside the top 10 include a Canadian, Patrick Carpentier in 12th, Michael Andretti in 13th, Newman Haas driver Christian Fittipaldi in 14th, Jimmy Vassar in 16th, and running right down the list to a Formula One refugee, Alex Zanardi, in 24th position. We'll, of course, bring you up to date with all of the results and stories from Toronto in next week's show.
The National Association of Speedway Racing has had a few changes over the last 6 months. One was the general manager, John Hughes, stepping down. He has been replaced in a different sense. A marketing and promotions manager, Chris Kingston, has been appointed as the man in charge of making Speedway a lot better known in the Australian community. And Chris joins us on the line now. It's a pretty big task that you have to undertake.
Yes, it is, Craig. It definitely is, but I'm really glad to have Peter Dodd as the general manager to kind of be overseeing my actions and helping me understand the politics and the past history with what we've got here with speedway racing in Australia. But it's a very exciting time for speedway racing in general across the country.
Now, by your accent, we can tell you're not a South Australian, and in fact, you come from the home of Speedway in a world sense, even though Australia was the creator of Speedway. You come from the world home of motorsport, Indianapolis.
That's correct. Yes, I've lived in the Midwest, grew up in the Midwest quite a bit, and then spent many different years in Indianapolis as well as Ohio, and glad to have that association. It was wonderful as a child to be able to go over to the Speedway for the time trials every year with the Indianapolis 500, as well as the 500 race itself, and there's quite a few different forms of Speedway racing over in the Midwest, so I'm pretty pleased to be here in Australia. Really not too many Americans really know how large Speedway is over here, but it's quite incredible how many people follow Speedway in this country.
Of course, Speedway in America is really, the focus is NASCAR, which of course runs on ovals of no less than 5/8 of a mile. In Australia, we don't have a Speedway that is paved or larger than about 3/4 of a mile.
Yes. Yeah, that's interesting, actually, with my work with the NASCAR Winston Cup programs and Busch Grand National. It most certainly is a very different form of racing. The United States kind of figured out it's a lot easier to build those speedways that hold 180,000, 200,000 people all with an oval compared to the road racing that might be over here with Formula One and the kart Indy race as well as the V8 supercar. So it's definitely quite different, to say the least, for the entertainment value or the entertainment image, but it's something that's it's kind of fun because it's so unique for me.
One thing that Speedway does have on the other motorsports is the spectator normally can see the entire racing circuit when he's at an event.
That's very true, and that's one of our major selling points that we're going to be plugging away at, one of many, that at Speedway here in Australia, you can sit at any one location in the grandstand, up in a corporate suite, or on the hill, and be able to catch all of the racing as it's taking place right in front of your eyes, whereas, you know, the V8 supercars of today, you know, you can wander around in some cases if you buy a general admission ticket, but honestly, it's very hard to track the racing and what's going on. So I feel that's a definite benefit to our speedway racing and what we need to be promoting to large corporations throughout Australia.
Now, you mentioned you did have a contact with Speedway whilst you were in the United States, and that was through Amoco, who you worked with on NASCAR Winston Cup circuit. But Amoco, of course, very well known for sponsoring sprint cars and the World of Outlaws, and particularly, of course, the Knoxville Nationals.
Yes, well, I hate to correct you, but we've tried very hard for 6 years now. I did manage the Amoco Knoxville Nationals, and yes, that was a wonderful experience, a great opportunity for me to work with Speedway in the United States, with the World of Outlaws, as well as Amoco as the corporation sponsoring the largest sprint car event in the world, and that's just invaluable experience that I've had, as well as you know, making so many contacts and just really good friends out of that. It's very much of a family atmosphere at Knoxville. There's some people that are at that event each year that have been for the last 20, 25 years. They always camp at the same places. The people next to them are the same people that they see once a year. And it's really exciting, actually. Speedway racing here in Australia, we need to start looking at what events have been around for the longest. The Classic, actually, at Warrnambool is one of our staple events, you know. And we need to find more of those there to be able to promote those to Speedway fans as well as non-fans, to get them kind of associated with how much history Speedway breeds in Australia. So.
Now, how big a coincidence is it that you used to be involved with the American Le Mans Series? Of course, they had their race last year in Adelaide, and now you're running NASA, or you're looking after the marketing promotion of NASA from South Australia and Adelaide.
Yeah, that's interesting. I actually have a really long history somehow already of South Australia and Adelaide in particular. I did help with various aspects of setting up the Le Mans race here at New Year's last year, with myself being the director of operations for the American Le Mans Series. That kind of put me in a role where I was speaking to a lot of different Aussies down here in Adelaide and starting those relationships. And then I also had met probably two other people at the Amoco Knoxville Nationals in years past, Trevor Green and Steve Green, are personal friends of mine now. And obviously, Trevor races, and Steve's very heavily associated with speedway racing around the country. And then I met about 5 to 6 individuals from Ratback Games that do the Sony PlayStation dirt sprint car racing for the Outlaws in the States. And so once I got down here to Adelaide, it just so happened that I had plenty of friends to visit right off the bat, and that's why I've kind of came to Adelaide to you know, just visit, and then I ended up settling here.
Now, of course, you've already started to roll out some of the new changes in how Speedway is going to be marketed and promoted from the National Association, with this week launching a brand new logo to identify Speedway racing around the country.
Yes, that's correct. We're extremely excited about it here. When one of my first things when I sat down in this new position and looked at it is what exactly is our product, and does our logo communicate our product to just the general fan and younger kids who have maybe never been to a speedway race? And the answer, frankly, was not really. And, you know, with the National Association of Speedway Racing, that is our identity and will continue to be our identity. But the new logo that is on our website now, which is www.nassar.asn.au, has the new logo, and it's at the bottom of it says Australian Speedway Racing, which, I mean, obviously, that's very important for us to just be able to communicate that and the national pride that we have here in this country with Speedway Racing. So we're very pleased with it. We believe that it's going to be more marketable, and that's just one of many new things that we're going to be doing to enhance our image and almost rebranding of our image and the marketability of Speedway Racing across this country. Mm-hmm. Many more exciting things to come down the road as well.
Of course, it's an interesting situation that Australia is in. It's a country with the same land mass as the United States, yet we have less tracks than the state of Indiana.
Yes. Well, Indiana is a very hard state to go and compare yourself against. It really is the home of all speed motorsports in general, just with just the grassroots farmers that go racing to, you know, young kids who are aspiring to either be an IRL driver or come up through the ranks of USAC or come up through USAC and then go off to NASCAR land and things of that nature and just so on and so forth. Some of them go to kart Indy racing, of course, and it's really interesting. But the landmass here, it really is a challenge for our competitors, and that's one thing that I really don't know how I'm going to be able to help, but it's just the matter of time and money and effort that they need to put in. Most of our competitors are just, they could be professionals, and they are professionals at Speedway Racing for the higher level associations, like the World Series Sprint Cars, for example, as we all know. But at the same time, our same drivers work full-time jobs year-round and typically take about 2 months off for that series that I just mentioned. And that's difficult. The landmass, the travel time, the cost of the petrol and everything really kind of plays on kind of inhibiting right now some of the growth. But we just need to find strategic ways around that. And I really believe one of the big ways for us is to keep working with media like yourself, with radio, print, TV, and then the Internet is going to be an integral part of our new strategy to try to just keep our a newer and higher level professional image out there for race fans and people that have never seen Speedway racing before.
One of the long-time problems with Speedway in Australia is that so many different states want to go off and do their own thing. If 10 leader sprint car drivers don't like the rules, they go off and call them the junior leader sprint cars and set up their own division.
Yes,
what are your plans in sort of amalgamating some of these similar divisions together so that you can get competitive numbers up in every class?
Well, I think that's a great question, and that's going to take unity by the whole entire country. It's going to take unity among the associations and different competitor groups that you mentioned, and that we have so many out there. I guess really it's one of those things that we're going to get to that eventually, but right now we're just asking promoters to start focusing on trying to not necessarily allow new series to start, but just try to persuade the competitors themselves to maybe blend that category and this category that are virtually identical except for like one or two different specs that then change the whole rule book and they go off racing differently. Obviously, one of the biggest things is everyone wants to be a winner. Everyone likes to race and you only race to win. And so it's an interesting challenge, and I think as a national body here that Nasser is, and we need to get the input from the competitors as well as the controlling bodies, all the major controlling bodies, and really sit down at the table and ask them, how do you think we can all do this? And not tell them, but work with them and try to negotiate and look for unity in that sense in the next year or two to really start that process. It's a very difficult question to answer right now, but we are going to be looking. That's one of many things that we will be looking at down the road.
Of course, people with Foxtel have experienced NASA's World of Speedway program, which has been one vehicle that you've previously been using to try and get a wider Speedway appeal.
Yes, absolutely. Wade Onger and John Hughes, when he was here, have just done a tremendous job with that show, and we really look forward to working with Wade once again and really maybe trying to exploit a little more of the marketing side of that. You know, the sponsors that we have on board right now, really show them the opportunities that we can go maybe to their world headquarters, let's say, being in Australia for any one of the corporations that are already associated with our racing, and really do like a tour, kind of like how the NASCAR people have done in the past with their sponsorships, And, you know, looking at, we will continue to see how we can be innovative with that program and to get the most value and exposure for our competitors as well as their sponsors. And I think a real thing, too, is to just keep educating and keep communicating to the different competitor bodies throughout this country that opportunity and how they can go about putting on, you know, race highlights or a special segment that they would like to do on the NASCAR World of Speedway. So those are definitely some opportunities we're looking at as well for the future.
Are you going to be working only with the national control councils, or are you going to also be working with the state control councils to try and get things like a Southwest and a North Tour going?
Oh, wow, great question. Actually, that's one question that no one's ever asked me since I've been here. I've really only been in the job full time now for several weeks, and before that I was just doing a lot of research on my own, working on the side on my own just to get ready for once the Australian government was allowing me to get my work visa, which I now have. But I tell you what, that's a great question. I think that's really something well down the road, you know, 10, 15 years down the road. We here at NASCAR will work with the state bodies themselves, but at the same time, I think we really need one effort for unity and to all be moving in the same direction to really get more race fans out to our facilities to enjoy the entertainment package that our competitors are putting on. And I think we all really need to focus on that for the next 5 years before we could really step outside and really look to expand in other ways.
So obviously your relationship with the Promoters Council is going to be a fairly important one to build on, because I know originally they were very reluctant to come on board with the national body.
Yeah, it's absolutely a must to have them, to have good relations with all of them, and I really have been fortunate to already meet quite a few of them with my travels when I first came to the country to just go and watch different forms of auto racing, especially speedway racing. But I think, too, just as important, and even really, frankly, equally, is the competitors themselves. Getting in front of them, getting their input, I value everything they have to say, and then really building those relationships of both parties are really going to help us for growth in the future.
Well, Chris, we look forward to seeing the progress of NASA's push to, it's a huge job to try and bring promoters and the clubs and associations together, because so far in the, I think it's now an 80-year history of Speedway in this country, it is always been the promoters and the bodies pulling themselves apart and thereby causing their own destruction.
Yeah, well, that's true. The bottom line is, one of my major sayings already is that we have power in numbers. We need to unite and really show the rest of Australia that we do have over 800,000 race fans that go to our events each year, as well as, just the consumer buying power for the corporations that are out there that could really take advantage of the opportunities that we have to present at a very good value compared to some other national and professional sports that are out here in our country. So, yeah, it's going to be quite an interesting road, and it's going to take time, but with everyone's help and some great volunteers, we're going to get it moving in the right direction. We already have started that process.
Well, Chris Kingston, the Marketing and Promotions Manager for NASA, the National Association of Speedway Racing, we're going to watch with interest the path as we certainly hope that Speedway can regain its position in motorsports halcyon days of the 60s.
Yes, absolutely, and even make it grow well beyond what the success that the 60s had into the 21st century. So,
thanks very much, Chris Kingston, for your time today on Inside Motorsport.
You're welcome. Take care.
One of the drivers that has been enjoying his time in the Subaru Impreza WRX STIs is Wayne Boatwright. Wayne coming off a great result at Canberra, having two good, strong performances. What brings a Bowral boy into the GT production series?
Thanks, Craig. Craig, I raced open wheelers in the early 90s and retired after a crash in 1994, and I was out of motor racing altogether. I actually bought one of these little incredible little WRX STIs as a road car myself in early 2000, and eventually got sucked back into doing a few private super sprint days, found myself involved with the New South Wales WRX Club, and did a couple of super sprints, and then one thing led to another. Mike Sainsbury called me up after one of the super sprints at Desert Creek and suggested that our time in my road car would have put me on the front row of the grid for the production series, so Mike thought it was a good idea to perhaps go GTP racing.
It is an interesting car, the Subaru. It certainly captured the imagination of, well, not only drivers, but of just the public watching it go around, because it has got some beautiful lines to it.
Yeah, they're a great little car. I mean, the Australia is actually the that has been the second largest market for the WRX, second to Japan, of course, today. The car is just being released now in its new form in the US, so the US market will obviously take over that that mantle. But it really has become something of a cult car in Australia, and I guess that's all about its its bang for buck sort of performance. I mean, the value for money is outstanding, really.
It also has seen you get a bit of support from the New South Wales Subaru WRX Club, which you have been involved in, as you mentioned. And it is interesting to see the club really getting behind you, where perhaps Subaru Australia haven't been so forthcoming in the past.
Yeah, the club is incredible. In fact, the New South Wales Impreza WRX Club, Craig, is the fastest growing car club in Australia. There are, it's grown to over 700 members in a couple of years. The motorsport program that the club has put together is incredible. We're typically getting 50 competitors to a club super sprint, the club has really got behind me. I say coming back from retirement came about from getting involved in a club super sprint. One of the enthusiastic members, Mike Sainsbury, decided that we wanted to go GTP racing. And we built the car in a few short weeks with the help of members of the club, and took it to Queensland Raceway about 12 months ago for our debut round. It is unfortunate, as you say, that Subaru in Australia themselves don't probably show enough interest in production racing. They've got a worldwide commitment to rallying as a policy for their marketing base. And of course, rallying in Australia, rallying is very strong in other parts of the world, particularly Europe. Probably doesn't quite have the interest of the tarmac racing does in Australia. In fact, we recently did a survey of the New South Wales Impreza WRX Club members, which indicated that 82%, in fact, of the members were more interested in the Australian GT Production Championship than they were in the Australian Rally Championship. So I think that's a statistic that we need to be holding under Subaru Australia's nose.
GTP is a very friendly group to be associated with. It's almost like a club atmosphere, although everyone's out there racing with expensive cars and also for limited cheap stations. You all do seem to have quite a good relationship between not only Subaru drivers, but you get those dastardly old Mustang drivers that can't keep them on all four wheels, and then you get a few Evo drivers that are pretty keen to dive off the track in front of you.
Yeah, now the guys in the Subaru, in the GTP ranks have been outstanding. I've been quite surprised actually at how relaxed things are in the paddock, even after you've been swapping paint with some of these guys. I've probably got as much Jacob Kenny Racing paintwork on my Subaru after last season as they have, and I've probably swapped paint with a lot of the front running GTP competitors. I think Gary Dean and Trevor Haynes and just got Jacob Grant Kenny. We've all had comings together at some point, and we've really never had a crossword over it. In fact, the guys are incredibly helpful to each other, and even within the Subaru ranks, we're often borrowing components. In Adelaide, you saw Trevor Haynes lending parts to Grant Kenny. You saw Scott Jacob lending engines back to Trevor Haynes in the second race at Wakefield Park. I borrowed a gearbox from Gary Dean. So I think, I'm really pleased to be involved with GTP from that point of view as well.
Now, I'm not sure what you do for a living, but you've done a few corporate talks, one of which I know was with the Goulburn Chamber of Commerce, where you talk about horsepower and business power coming together.
Yeah, we Ross Palmer and the people at Procar just were interested in you know, generating a little bit of interest and in, you know, with the business community in Goulburn. I'm sort of a local boy. I don't live too far from Goulburn here in the Southern Highlands. And we were invited just to talk to the local community about, you know, some of the benefits that can accrue to a local community by getting behind motor racing activity, and you know, we've only got to look at the success of you know, events like Bathurst and Canberra and Adelaide to see that the community can, you know, benefit, the local business community can benefit substantially by getting involved with circuit owners like Wakefield Park and promoters like Procar in trying to make these events a success. And I think the outstanding success of Procar's first standalone race meeting at Wakefield Park, where they had the biggest crowd that Wakefield had ever had, even bigger than the V8 Supercar meeting that had been held there a few months earlier, underlined, the benefit to the local community that motorsport can bring.
Mm. Were you surprised when you would have been at Wakefield Park previously for Subaru Club Days? Were you surprised when you came back there for this race meeting and saw the development work that Gary Holton and Gary Wilmington have set about doing at the track?
Yeah, I think, in fact, it was the first time that I'd actually driven on a new Wakefield format, you know, despite being supposedly the local boy. For a variety of reasons, we hadn't actually got down there to do much with our Subaru. I'd done a few laps around Wakefield in a V8 supercar a few months earlier, but we'd never actually driven my own Subaru there. And I must say, having been involved with Wakefield Park from its very beginnings, I think, you know, the track is now dramatically improved. They've opened it up; it's faster. It's now a very enjoyable little circuit to drive, and you know, fantastic for the for the crowds in terms of being able to see the action.
Mm. And the track did put on some great racing with all the different divisions that Procar have to offer. Of course, your next outing is another standalone meeting at Queensland Raceway, which once again everyone will be hoping will be as big a success as Wakefield Park was.
Yeah, Queensland Raceway will be great. We debuted our car at Queensland Raceway last year. We probably weren't quite ready. In fact, we were tuning the Motec in qualifying. So, you know, we were a long way from being totally prepared for it, and we ended up, in fact, Grant Kenny and I had a bit of a coming together there, and took us both out of the race. But I'm sure we'll put on a good show, you know, for the people in Queensland. I think it's a circuit unlike the circuits we've been to so far, like Adelaide and Wakefield and Canberra. It's, Queensland's a very fast open circuit that'll suit the big horsepower of the Mustangs and the Commodores, and of course you've got a whole bunch of local yokels up there that are going to be hard to beat in Grant and Scott, and as well as people like Kingy.
Yeah, it is going to be an interesting outing, and we do wish you all the best as you get set for the Queensland Raceway in only a couple of weeks' time now. And of course before then, the Class D and E get their outing at Lakeside, which well, the breaking up of the classes, how have you felt about that? Because obviously you're not running up on back markers quite as quickly as what you were.
Yeah, I must admit, Craig, when that concept was first mooted, I was not necessarily in favour of it. My initial reaction was that I quite enjoyed the variety of the five class structure, and I also really enjoyed racing and having to work your way through the traffic. And there's obviously a lot of that when you're talking about the class C, D, and E cars. But I think that the pressure on the grid is so substantial. I mean, it's indicative of the success of Ross Palmer's Procar operation that there's just an over demand for grid positions in Class A and Class B, and I think it was the only way that we had to go. Hopefully, I mean, and I think, that next year you'll see the GT Performance category get bigger and bigger again, and hopefully also, C, D, and E, your GT Production category, will replenish a little bit. But I think all in all, the splitting of the categories was something that we needed to do.
It was almost getting to the stage where the grids were getting that big that you had to split them. And at the moment, as you said, well, one grid might not be completely full. But if the previous history of how Procar's been running is anything to go by, it won't take long till they are full grids and they'll be looking at splitting A and B and splitting D and E into their own races outright.
Yeah, that's something that I think has been rumoured. I mean, people have seen that the natural progression could be in that direction, and I think there is an argument for splitting Class A out by itself, and from the B class point of view, I mean, those guys will then be racing for outright honours, and it will also top up the GT production field. So, my own personal preference for going forward would probably be to split out Class A altogether. There's no question that you'd immediately fill that grid, and I think Proco will have to move to pretty strictly control the number of cars representing each mark. I would envisage a situation where if that does happen, you'll see the thing strictly controlled to maybe 4 or 5 or 6 Subarus, Hondas, Fords, BMWs, Holdens, etc.
You could be getting into a situation where you're pre-qualifying to represent your class in an actual race meeting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, right now we've got, I think there are 5 Subaru championship entrants for the series, and there are probably a dozen Subarus out there trying to actually get on the grid. Same with Mitsubishis. I mean, there are more than enough cars that are trying to qualify, and of course at some circuits like Wakefield Park we've only got 36 grid positions. I think Queensland, like places like Queensland Raceway and Sandown, that's less of a problem, but I suspect that the success of production car racing means that we're going to see increasingly full grids right through this season and next.
Inside Motorsport will return after these messages.
Life can be cruel, not a lot you can do, but it helps if you've got a friend. A friend you can share with, comfort and care with. There's nothing quite like a friend. Nothing quite like a friend.
For more than 70 years, Lorna has played the pipe organ for church and charity. Now she's been given something in return, the Order of Australia and a delightfully affectionate Betts' therapy companion dog called Ebony. Because of her frail condition, Lorna only occasionally plays the pipe organ these days, but still loves to play piano at home, usually to a highly appreciative audience of one, Ebony. You can help the Guide Dog Association train more pets as therapy companion dogs like Ebony by sending your donation today.
Got a message?
Need to be heard.
Why not tell Canberra on Triple S FM? If you're a community group or non-profit organisation
with an upcoming event you'd like to promote,
contact the team at Triple S to air your community announcement.
Let us know 2 weeks in advance of your event by faxing us on 624-7706.
Or email us on sss@acttab.com.au.
Or just give us a call on 625-7248. 103.9 Triple S FM, working to support your community.
Inside Motorsport, from the racetrack to your radio.
And this weekend, it was round 7 of the Australian Touring Car Championship as the V8 Touring Cars headed to Calder Park, just near Melbourne. And to be quite honest, we expected it to be a bit of a yawn. It was back to the old format of 3 20-minute sprint races, and I think everyone was fully expecting the pole man, Mark Scaife, to win the Turn 1 battle and just keep everyone comfortably behind him and cruise to a runaway victory. Well, it was far from that. In fact, really, it was an upset victory, a guy we have not seen at the front of the V8 touring cars before, and obviously he was very excited by it, and that, of course, is the big Kev Commodore of Paul Morris putting in an excellent performance there to take out. It wasn't really an easy victory. He had people barking on his heels for the whole of the 3 races, but at the end, he sort of did it comfortably. race one was where most of the drama really started, and it was turn one. Junior Johnson, Steve Johnson, won the start, and Scaife was playing catch-up from there. And they all braked pretty late into turn one, Scaife bumping Junior Johnson, and it was enough of a bump to push him a little bit wide. Of course, the debate will run about whether he was going to run wide anyway because of everyone coming into that turn rather hot. But the stewards of the meeting felt that Scaife had indeed bumped him offline and gave Scaife a stop-go penalty. And Channel 10 weren't brave enough to give us any audio from the radio scanners to see what Scaife was saying to the crew. I could imagine it would have been pretty colourful language based on his Canberra performance. So that was really the end of race one for Mark Scaife, and it looked like he'd have a pretty hard fight to fight back from all of that. There was also other action in turn one with Murphy spinning out. Looked as though Mark Larkham gave him a bit of a tap into a spin, and then all hell broke loose. Craig Lowndes was off in the grass trying to avoid it, and also young Kelly and Ambrose had a bit of a tangle, with Kelly coming out for the worst there with a bit of tyre damage. So it went on with lap six, Mark Scaife taking his stop-go penalty, which really left Steve Johnson to cruise home for a reasonably easy victory there. Murphy, however, had a big fight back throughout the race, trying to make up plenty of positions. He effectively rejoined the race dead last and had a very aggressive run through the field, pushing a few people out of the way. And I think we can expect a few entries in the Avesco listing of bad boys from the round. I think young Murphy might have a few entries there from acting a little bit too aggressively.
He might also have a requirement to open up his checkbook and pay a few dollars to the Christmas fund.
Yes, it could be. So in race one, it was Steve Johnson taking out the victory from Paul Morris. Now, we remember that at Perth, Paul Morris also had a good qualifying performance, but the car set up and the tyre wear meant that he couldn't hang on to that position. That wasn't the case this weekend, and in race number one, he went home to a pretty good second place finish. Running through some of the other results in race one, Marcus Ambrose in third, Russell Ingall had a consistent run into fourth, Paul Radisich, the poor old rat, had a shocking time in qualifying, qualified outside the top 10, mainly because Dean Canto had a bit of a lose and took out the rat, quite a bit of damage to both cars there. So Paul Radisich was playing catch-up and did quite well, starting outside the top 10 and finishing fifth in that first race. Jason Bright continued to be quite consistent in the second of the HRT cars, coming home in sixth position. David Bernard had a race that was fairly incident-free. I couldn't say the same for the rest of the day, but Bernard took seventh in that first race from Ellery, Steve Richards, Garth Tander. Some of the names that were well and truly out of the top 10, Murphy, who we've spoken about, really rejoined way back in 30th after that turn one incident. He fought back to 17th position. Glenn Seaton's had a shocker all weekend. Qualified 20th, and just, you know, he tracked down the problem there. That was a spark lead that was shorting a bit, so an engine misfire. So that was his excuse out of the way. But during the race, he really didn't seem to improve. He finished 19th. And Mark Scaife, after the stop-go penalty, he sort of cruised around a little bit to make up a few positions to get a few points, but he really wanted to save the tyres for later in the day, and he finished 25th after race number one.
Yeah, and that's a sort of interesting result there, particularly with Stephen Johnson following on with the success we've seen from the Shell Helix Racing team, and in particular the excellent showing they had at Canberra and also with Paul Radisich over in Perth. So obviously they're on the up. And Paul Morris, of course, he was on the up as well.
Yeah, before the season started, the team here, we had a bit of speculation about who were going to be the stars. And out of the four teams, you know, we're expecting the usual names, Paul Radisich, Seaton, and we thought Lowndes would be up there. But if you look at the point score now for the championship, the young Ford drivers really have the consistency that we didn't expect from them. Stephen Johnson and also Ambrose. Ambrose has had an up and down year, but he's still consistently bagging some points. So a bit of a surprise there. Race two, there was a few spots of rain before this one, and quite ironic, isn't it? All the Melbourne teams, when they come to Canberra, they complain about the cold, miserable weather. We all know that Melbourne is equally miserable at times, so that was quite good to see them all rugged up and whining about the cold. The start of race two was really determined the outcome. Paul Morris had a good start,
Steve Johnson had a terrible start. From pole position, Steve Johnson ended up in sixth. So that was really the paid to his weekend of being able to take out the round victory. The talking point in race two was Mark Scaife fighting his way back through the field. He finished 11th. So again, fighting through the field, doing an excellent job, which, you know, we always know is a risk from Mark Scaife, that he can fight back from adversity really well. Paul Morris, really, he's very defensive in his driving, taking very narrow, tight lines through the corners, making sure that if anyone was going to pass, they were going to do it the way, way long way around. Got the flag suggesting that he was blocking a bit too much, the bad sportsmanship flag, but no further action was taken. He sort of neatly balanced his defensive driving with just what the officials would allow. And in the end, yes, he was holding them up a bit of a train of four cars behind him. But in the end, it didn't matter. He comfortably took that victory, and running through the positions there, Paul Morris in the Big Kev Commodore was first, Russell Ingalls second. Russell, again, quite consistent. He's going to be a contender for the championship if he keeps this up. Jason Bright in third, Paul Radisich in fourth, Marcus Ambrose in fifth, Steve Johnson, yes, that terrible start really did put paid to his day, finishing sixth. Steve Richards, he qualified outside the top 10 at the start of the weekend. He had a fairly good run to take home 7th position in race number 2. Garth Tander, also terrible qualifying, consistent through the races, into 8th, followed by Ellery, McConville, Scaife, and Craig Lowndes was missing in action quite a bit throughout the weekend. Race 2, all he could manage was 15th.
Now, I'd say that Craig Lowndes there is obviously hanging out for his brand new Falcon, which supposedly should debut at the Oran Park Round of the Championship, and that's the Gibson Motorsport built car. A few tweaks, and apparently a car that will much better suit him. And the current car, of course, gets handled down to Neil Crompton, so he can hopefully get up his microphone.
Yes, yeah, a bit of a stab there at good old Cromley. He does a fair job on the microphone. It'll be interesting to see if he does a fair job in that car. I think that's when we'll find out just how good Lowndes has been this year, when you put another driver into that same car, which is, quite frankly, getting long in the tooth. So it'll be quite a good barometer there for the relative performance. And yeah, Oran Park 2 weeks away, looking forward to that immensely, to see the new car. And really, I don't think we're going to see a new sponsor on that car this year. At the start of the year, we're all expecting big fanfare and some huge naming rights. Was it going to be Vegemite for the Vegemite kid? And other names were thrown around, but there's really nothing coming out. And I guess they're falling into the same sort of trap and the same sort of market out there at the moment for sponsors, the same one that's got Mark Larkham struggling a bit.
Mm. And that is a problem, that there's only so many dollars to go around. Of course, race three was really where the day's results got tied up.
Yes, very tight sort of track there at Calder Park, fairly hard to pass, so really the start is where it's at. And for race number three, Paul Morris got another good start. The other guy who got a great start was Paul Radisich. He sort of blasted away and took second position quite comfortably. It was Russell Ingall who lost out a little bit and ended up third in the train. Larry Perkins was a bit of a talking point in race three, spinning out and taking out a number of cars with him, which called out a safety car. After that, the running order was Morris from Radisich, Ingall, Steve Johnson and Bright, and they sort of battle on, but there wasn't a whole lot of passing to be seen. And so that's how the race finished. Outright for the day, when you combine all of those heats, the outright for the round was, of course, Paul Morris from Steve Johnson, Russell Ingall, Paul Radisich. Fifth was Jason Bright, taking out another good collection of points, which has really narrowed the gap in the points. And Marcus Ambrose was sixth. And we caught up to Steve Johnson, the best of the four drivers there today.
Well, following up from a good showing in Canberra a few weeks ago is Stephen Johnson of the Shell Helix Racing Team. Stephen, congratulations on a fine second place today at Calder.
Thanks, Colin. It was a good result for the whole Shell team today, but a little mistake on my part sort of put paid to a round victory this weekend.
Now, in the first race, you had a bit of fun and games with Mark Scaife, as people saw.
Yeah, we had a bit of a touch and that at the first turn, and you can't do that sort of thing to gain spots, and they come up pretty quickly, and Mark paid the penalty for it.
Mm. At that stage, it looked like you had the race there fairly well under control till the finish.
Yeah, it was just one of those races where I put my head down for the two or three laps after Mark went into the pits, and pull a bit of a gap quite easily, and just maintained it for the rest of the race.
Now, of course, your second race, a bit of a shocker of a start. What was going through your mind? You watched all those cars go past.
I wasn't happy. I was just trying to get the thing going, but just a small mistake, like I said before, on my behalf. And being that I was on the inside, the track's not quite as grippy there, so I didn't quite use as much throttle. And when I let the clutch go, the car just bogged down and wouldn't go. So I had a couple of stabs at the clutch to try to get it to go, and by that stage, three or four, or the back two rows had passed me, so I went from first to sixth pretty quickly.
Mm. Now, of course, in the third race, then a good fight back to get yourself right up there again.
Yeah, we fought back hard in the last race. I got probably the best start I've got all weekend in the last race, and moved up to fourth, and realistically, that's as far as we could go. We couldn't pass Engel, and Paul couldn't pass Paul Morris. So, I mean, it was just one of those situations where you had to wait for somebody to make a mistake, and unfortunately, none of the guys up front did.
Mm. Now, in this case, you've actually sort of now put yourself even in a better position in regards to the championship. You've actually jumped yourself up a fair way on Mark Scaife, who's leading the championship.
Yeah, we've gained quite a few points, and we're going to continue to do that, hopefully, at Oran Park and so forth. If we have a good Queensland 500, we could end up leading the championship after that stage. So, realistically, we're in with a very, very good shot.
In regards to Oran Park in a fortnight's time, what are your thoughts on the Oran Park circuit?
Oran Park's fantastic. I mean, it's just one of those tracks that I really enjoy to drive on. And realistically, I think we've got a good chance with the way the cars are handling at the moment.
Mm. Well, Stephen, hopefully we'll catch up to you at Oran Park in a fortnight's time. And once again, congratulations on second place today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate.
Yeah, Stephen Johnson there. And very quick to say, he made a mistake. You're not saying, something wrong in the car. He admits openly he made the mistake.
Yes, he really has been the find of the year. Ambrose has been pretty spectacular, but I think Steve Johnson, and it shows in the points as well, Steve Johnson is consistent and he's fast. He's sort of come from nowhere. Last year he wasn't performing very well when Paul Radisich was getting results in that Shell Falcon, but a fairly extensive training program during the off-season. A bit of a mental realignment there as well, and it really is delivering the results, and that's fantastic to see. Now, we'd normally speak to Paul Morris around this time as well. We'd normally get hold of him for a chat, but it's quite obvious that they're pretty excited in that team, and they're off doing some other things, like partying pretty hard.
I would say that knowing Big Kev and his propensity to party, that they would be partying hardy, and there'd be some very, very hungover people heading back to their home base, which is up in Queensland, tomorrow morning.
Yes, and I think it is fantastic for the sport to see one of these lesser teams get up there and get some good results. And it really does show some promise for teams that do have a fantastic heritage and fantastic results in other categories. You know, the Oz Email team of Brad Jones is the next one. They're obviously an excellent team, but they haven't had any luck. They haven't had any success in the V8s yet. And Paul Morris has shown that there is hope for these, the second tier of level one, the guys who run around with one team with a much lower budget. Yes, it can be done, and it doesn't need a reverse grid. He's really won on his own merit, and that's fantastic to see.
Yeah, good one to see there for them. In terms of championship round, it really makes it quite tight.
Yes, Mark Scaife, he has sort of slipped back into the pack a little bit in the championship race. He's still leading on 1,720 points, but Jason Bright is right there snapping at his heels with 1,703, so there's not much there at all. All Scaife needs is some sort of a points penalty thrown on him. During the television telecast, he did say that the stewards and everything was unprofessional, so we'll see how much of that the official can take, particularly on top of his comments that made it to air at the Canberra round. I don't think he's going to be very popular among the Avesco head honchos who like a nice clean family image to come out. Mm. Anyway, in third in the championship is Russell Engel. The enforcer is being very consistent this year, and that's what it takes for these championships. He's a few points back on 1,496. It's getting pretty close there as well. A good run from Engel today. Steve Johnson, the best of the Fords, on 1,488. So there's a bit of a gap there to Scaife way back down to Johnson, but,
these crook rounds do come up every now and then. Everyone has to have them, so that can happen again to SCAFE before the end of the year, and who knows what we'll see. And then the next is Ambrose, also in a Ford.
Well, there was more than just the V8s racing today at Calder. We also had the latest round of the 2001 Australian Formula Ford Championship, and there it was an interesting one in the fact that we had the top two guys swapping places between the two races. In the first race, it was Will Davidson in the Gary Rogers Motorsport Van Diemen winning from the VIP Pet Foods Van Diemen of Will Power. In the second race, swap them around, and you got the top two there as well. Filling up the minor placings in the first race for the Formula Fords was Jamie Wincup in third, and then Stuart Costera in fourth, and Marcus Marshall in fifth. In the second race, it was Stuart Costera, David Clark, and Marcus Marshall rounding out the five. Quite a good race there for the Formula Ford races. And, of course, the Formula Holden Australian Drivers' Championship, that was running as well. And there it was a double win for young Holden Young Lions racer Rick Kelly. He won both races from Christian Murchison with Emerson Newton-John, his first race with the Rolt Australia team, Graham Watson, finishing third in both races there. As it was, we were lucky we were able to catch up with Rick Kelly not long after the race.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, we had two from two, which was pretty impressive. The team have done a great job this weekend to get the car up and running. We just had to make a few changes, a few minor changes throughout the weekend to ensure that we finished first in both races, and we pulled it off, which was great.
As it was, you had Christian Murchison sitting in there behind you along with Emerson Newton-John, probably making it quite difficult for you.
Yeah, I didn't get the best starts I've ever had, so they were right on me in the start and gave me a little bit of a hurry up for the first few laps, which was certainly made me pull my finger out and get up there and try and get a few quick laps in to get a bit of a gap, which we didn't maintain, so it was great.
In terms of the track at Calder, it's a fairly tight track, and people have been saying it's fairly slippery as well. How did you find it with the Formula Holden?
Yeah, actually, it's pretty bumpy throughout the braking areas on the main straight, so it's a matter, I guess, of setting the car up around those, and they are long straight, so we've really got to make sure the car gets down there, which the team done this weekend and done well.
Now, from here, where's your next race?
We moved to Oran Park in a fortnight, so we'll be down there this week doing a little bit of testing and trying to get his car set up and trying different things with suspension and aerodynamics to see what works best for the circuit.
Mm. You've obviously raced at Oran Park before?
Only once in the Formula Ford last year, but we had a good result there, so I'm confident of doing well in the Formula Holden.
Mm. Well, Rick, congratulations on your two wins today, and we'll keep an eye on things that go for you in a couple of weeks' time at Oran Park.
All right, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, Rick Kelly there in the Holden Young Lions team car. One of those young drivers, obviously, the V8 teams are keeping their eye on for the endurance races and similar.
Yes, that's right. That's a car that is supported by the Holden Racing team and really is giving him a bit of an edge in that category. It's a category that really does have a bright future ahead of it, but they do need to get more competitors and a bit more money into the class. Otherwise, you do get this situation where you get a handful of cars that have the better support, and, of course, they're going to dominate. But it really is the breeding ground for our up-and-coming drivers, and something we have to really foster and make sure that it goes to strength to strength.
Yeah, we're also able to catch up with our second place man, Christian Murchison, another one who's already, I think, got himself tied up with one of the teams for a race later in the year. And this is what he had to say about the view sitting behind the leader.
Yeah, it's a little bit unfortunate. I mean, the team and I, we've been trying so hard recently, especially this weekend, and we've been making inroads every single time we take the car out on the track. So we're slowly clawing our way up towards Rick, but he's just been, you know, driving and doing a great job. So unfortunately, it was sort of a couple of tenths off every single lap, which I suppose ends up turning into quite a large gap by the end of the race.
Have you been able to identify any particular area where you think maybe his car has got something over yours, or...?
Well, previously it's been horsepower, but, I mean, Chris Hocking and the team have been trying very hard to rectify the problem, and they've, I think they've done quite a good job. We're really not that far off in the horsepower area at the moment, and it's sort of really looking at just fine-tuning the car and finding a little bit everywhere, and I think we should be a lot closer.
Come the next meeting at Oran Park, do you think you'll probably be that little bit closer?
I think we will be, because I think Oran Park's definitely a lot more challenging as a circuit. Calder sort of relies mainly on horsepower, with the two long straights, and the corners are very slow speed. So, I mean, Oran Park's also very physically demanding in comparison. So hopefully I'll be a bit fitter than Rick, and hopefully we'll be able to get the car set up a little bit better, and we'll be a lot closer.
Mm. It's always one of the things, isn't it, when you've got somebody who's out there seeing the benchmark, is to try and find the ways to claw them back that bit and just identifying what it is.
Well, that's right. I mean, Burano have got the experience now, and they've been winning championships and races for a long time now, so they've basically got everything set in place, and they know exactly what to expect, and they've got all their setups. Whereas at Hocking Motorsport here at the moment, we're still learning every single time we take the car out. We're still developing the car, so it sort of takes time to catch up and to learn and to get to their sort of position.
Mm. But you wouldn't be too upset with two good second places from today's meeting?
No, I'm not too upset. I mean, it's always nice to win, and I'm a little disappointed that we didn't, because I was hopeful that we would get a good chance. But, you know, I mean, it's not a bad effort, and, I mean, we're making inroads every single time we draw, so I'm looking forward to Oran Park.
Well, Chris, hopefully next time we talk to you, it might be that one step higher on the podium.
I hope so.
Christian Murchison, thank you for joining us on Inside Motorsport tonight.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, we have some pretty exciting young drivers coming through Formula Holden, and of course they all have their eyes on overseas and the big time, and we have some good drivers over there at the moment getting some good results, Colin.
Well, that's right. One driver who's the closest to that golden apple of Formula One, of course, is Mark Webber. They had the latest round of the Formula 3000 Championship at Silverstone, supporting the British Grand Prix yesterday, and unfortunately for Mark, they're not as good a day as he would have liked. He finished fourth overall in his Supernova team car. He was behind Sebastian Bourdais in the Dams team from France, behind Justin Wilson of Nordic, and Antonio Pizzoni. Apparently he was the guy who really flew through that race. But it's not too bad, because it's actually put Mark within 4 points of Wilson, who is leading the championship. So it's going to go down to the wire, that one, that's for sure. Trick with Mark, of course, is try and catch hold of him these days. He's a very busy chap. The other Australian who's due to have his first test drive for Formula One is, of course, James Courtney. He has his first test next Tuesday, and they've got a Formula 3 International Invitation Challenge for drivers in that Formula 3 Championship from around the world, and that's also at Silverstone. They'll be racing as one of the front runners today, and he has qualified 10th for that race. Takuma Sato, who's currently leading the British Championship, he's currently on the pole position there. Apparently Courtney had some problems with his car during qualifying. And the other young Australian, which is Ryan Briscoe, who is the man that Toyota have picked for the future, he apparently last week won his latest round of the Italian Formula Renault Championship, and he's looking very, very good for things there. But interesting this week as well to see that Toyota has said that they feel like they're being made very much the new boys on the block, and are being left out of a lot of things that the other Formula One teams are doing. So a bit of the new boy attitude there.
Does that mean Toyota, they want to feel like they belong, they need to go up and down the pit lane with cameras and do a bit of espionage and spying on the other teams? Is that how they want to feel and belong?
I think what it is that they're threatened, that the other teams feel threatened by Toyota's entry into the sport. So things looking quite interesting there. And, of course, some of the teams have accused them of, poaching team members, and the fact that they attended the Formula One opening race here in Australia using the trip as a recruitment exercise. Their response was, telephone calls are cheaper than a trip to Australia.
Well, Bob Jayne was the first man to win at Calder Park in touring cars, and yesterday he relived the 69 glory as he jumped into Glenn Seaton's AU Falcon to take on a V8 supercar on the 25th anniversary of Calder Park Raceway's involvement with the Australian Touring Car Championship. I caught up with Bob and asked him if he could take on the young guns today in a V8 supercar.
I don't want to, but if I could.
You, of course, won the first ever round at Calder Park. Now you own it. Is that a bit like Remington? You liked it so much you bought the company?
You're a bit like that, yes. I had to buy the company to keep it going, unfortunately, at the time, back in in those days.
When you talk about driving a Ford Mustang back in those days, battling against people like Leo Gagan and Norm Beachy and the variety of cars that were out on the track with you, it's come a long way, this motor racing game.
Well, the Super V8s have certainly done very, very well, and even Ford versus Holden, is absolutely fantastic.
For yourself, is this the first time you've gotten into a V8 supercar in its current specs?
Yes, it is, actually. I was very, you know, pleasantly surprised. Glenn Seaton was kind enough to let me use his race car. And I was a bit I was not nervous about driving it. I was nervous about damaging it, I mean. But I took fairly good care of it.
It's the 25th running of a Shell Championship Series event, which was formerly, of course, the Australian Touring Car Championship event at Calder Park. How have you seen Calder Park changing over the years since you were just a competitor?
Well, it's gone from being a mile circuit, which is 1.6 kilometres, to being about a 3.8 kilometre circuit. Both circuits are still intact, but there's a long circuit which the racing this coming weekend will be on the 2.8 circuit. I'm sorry, do my calculations in my head. About 2.8, 2.9 kilometre circuit, which is a very interesting circuit. Some people say it's very simple, but it isn't. It's got a long, very fast straight which falls away very fast, very heavy on braking, narrows down a little bit, and comes through some S's and up a hill and over a hill through an S down the back straight. So it's a very demanding circuit on driving skills and brakes. The car's got to have good brakes. Brakes that endure because of the speed.
Well, of course, you're celebrating 25 years of the Shell Touring Car Championship this weekend at Calder Park Raceway, and Bob, you've been a major part of those 25 years.
I believe so, and it's been a wonderful 25 years, I can assure you.
Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple S FM Canberra via Comrade Sat with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.